Lately, I feel like I start each show by acknowledging just how much news comes at us every week. And then we here at Marketplace try to create a roadmap to process all of it and pull out threads that fit with our mission. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And this week was honestly a lot. The congressional baseball shooting, the Grenfell fire in London, the president's tweet that he's being investigated for firing FBI Director Jim Comey. And in the business world, the news that Amazon is buying Whole Foods. So, yes, another relentless week in the news.
I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States.
Shortly after 7 a.m. this morning, a gunman opened fire on members of Congress and their staffs.
President Trump's businesses and his dealings violate the Constitution's anti-corruption provisions, known as the emoluments clauses.
That was Attorney General Jeff Sessions, President Trump, and D.C.'s Attorney General Carl Racine. And since this is Marketplace, we're going to start with that emoluments clause. It says a president can't accept gifts from foreign governments. Two lawsuits, one by D.C. and Maryland and one by Democrats, were filed against the president this week for allegedly violating it. But what happens to a president's agenda and attempts to make policy when the president gets sued? We brought in Andy Wright to explain. He served in the White House counsel's office during the Clinton and Obama administrations.
Things can escalate very quickly. And, you know, there's both the legal issues going on, maybe with Department of Justice, maybe with civil litigants or congressional subpoenas. And it can have an effect on the media environment that can end up becoming sort of all-consuming for the West Wing. And so one of the things that you have to do right away when you're one of the lawyers and one of the communications staffers who's dedicated to the legal issues is try to make sure you can sort of cauterize all of that noise, compartmentalize the White House so that the president and the senior staff of the White House can continue to do the job on behalf of the American people, and the legal issues can be properly handled by the legal professionals and the dedicated communications folks. So it's kind of like, you know, protecting the quarterback on the blind side. It's not super glamorous, but it's very, very important if the team is going to move the ball forward.
You worked in the Clinton White House when the White House was being sort of subpoenaed very frequently. What was that like?
You know, it was really distracting and all-consuming for the legal staff. I mean, you know, after Bush v. Gore, my parting gift from the administration as I continued to represent Vice President Gore was 13 binders containing over 1,000 subpoenas that the White House had received during the Clinton administration that I had to take with me because I was continuing to respond to subpoenas, and we were still getting new subpoenas related to the administration's conduct afterwards. Once the dam breaks and it really becomes open season that has both the sort of legitimate legal issues and the partisan incentives for the critics of the president to pile on, it can really get out of hand in a hurry.
You know, we have heard the president and his staff reference various things and say they're a distraction from the work they're trying to do. What doesn't get done if a White House is tied up in litigation?
A lot of things can happen. I mean, there's just a lot of battery pack that gets burned if your chief of staff or your, you know, communications director or your senior advisors are fielding calls and dealing with searches of their files, going through their emails and having to produce documents in response to subpoenas, et cetera. That's very distracting. If they're getting criticized in the media, that also takes a personal toll. And so that means all the things you're trying to do on behalf of the economy, in foreign affairs, and other important critical decisions that have to be made, there's an opportunity cost to those substantive projects because of the process of litigation and the risks that it entails.
I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about with this administration is a president who clearly values loyalty. But if you are a staffer who's saying, I'm trying to serve the American people or I'm trying to protect the institution of the presidency, that's a pretty hard thing to do at once, serve the president and serve the institution.
Yeah. So first thing, you know, if you're a White House lawyer, your first and foremost job is to create a culture of compliance. You've taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution, just like the president and other senior advisors have. So you need to make sure that the constitutional provisions are being complied with, that statutes are being complied with. That's an incredibly important job. And one of the critical jobs of the president and the other senior leaders in the White House is to make sure that they heed sound legal advice and that they back up the lawyers to empower them to make sure that others in their organization and their orbit follow the law. So one of the things that I think is going on right now is the president, in this insistence on loyalty, as it's been reported, is creating an incredible strain on conflict that the lawyers face, because there doesn't seem to be a president who has undertaken the same sense of obligation about a culture of compliance that the lawyers have. So they're now sort of running around trying to plug up holes in the dam rather than being on the same page with the president.
What things are the job of the White House counsel's office, and what things are the job of a private attorney, which certainly President Clinton had, President Trump has? You know, who does what?
Sure. Well, it's incredibly important to have a private attorney when the president faces any significant legal jeopardy or has litigation touching on their personal affairs, because that allows the White House lawyers to continue to focus solely on their job, which is doing government jobs, serving the American people. So those are very distinct roles. There is a lot of overlap, however, between them sometimes in something like this. So, for example, if there's litigation that is going to touch on the Trump organization, but it also touches on the president's official duties, there may be subpoenas that come out of the litigation that hit both the Trump organization as a private business and also the White House records that are, governed by the Presidential Records Act. So the White House lawyers may have an important role in compliance with the legal process happening related to the litigation, but they should never substitute that obligation for taking on a representation of the president in his personal capacity. So that's one of those things that you have to spend quite a bit of time discerning as a lawyer and trying to make sure that you stay in your lane and continue to work on behalf of the American people. But it's not always completely intuitive. So you have to really spend time and take it very seriously.
You know, people listening to this may say, all of this seems really academic. What are the stakes for an average American if a White House is sort of batting away lawsuits coming toward it?
Well, there are a couple of very tangible results. First of all, there's the opportunity cost of all of the distraction at the White House, which means that the things that the people that voted for the president and sent him there to do aren't getting done. They're not getting the same amount of devoted time to them. So there's a cost there. Second of all, the worse the atmospherics are of the litigation, if there are bad documents that start to tumble out into the public space because of document requests and subpoenas, that poisons the atmosphere for the politics, both in terms of the litigation. It makes it harder to win cases in the courts, but more importantly, it poisons the atmosphere in Congress. It is academic at the first instance, but it's the beginning of something, a chain of causation that can end up really swamping an administration. You know, I think during the Clinton administration, we felt like we lost several years of initiative. Obviously, the president was doing his job every day, but there were just a ton of opportunity costs lost to the impeachment fight. And so you just hate to see that happen if you're someone who's worked so hard to put someone that you agree with on substantive policy in office.
Andy Wright worked in the White House counsel's office in both the Clinton and Obama administrations and is now a professor at Savannah Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. And as you know, we here at Marketplace are all about numbers. We like to make sense of the news and the economy by putting them into context. That's why we do the week's news by the numbers. Marketplace's Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner take care of that. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
46.
That's many years it's been since John Lennon released his biggest solo hit, Imagine.
Now, nearly half a century later, his wife and collaborator Yoko Ono will get writing credit for the famous song.
While many feel the credit is long overdue, there's already some opposition to crediting Ono.
The song is covered a lot, and this move would extend the copyright 70 years past Ono's death.
$22 million.
That's how many dollars sponsors are expected to spend on the upcoming Mayweather-McGregor fight.
Between ticket and pay-per-view sales, the boxing match could break the $623.5 million fight record set by the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight in 2015.
One thing that might keep this match from breaking the record, Mayweather is currently heavily favored to win the fight.
At one Las Vegas outlet, bettors would have to wager $1,100 on Mayweather just to win $100.
95.
That's a percentage that the population of the rusty patched bumblebee is estimated to have declined, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The rusty patched bumble is the first native bee species to be listed as endangered in the continental U.S.
Loss of bees might cost us too. Native pollinators like the rusty patched bumble are valued at more than $9 billion annually.
Some of the most popular crops rely on what's known as buzz pollination. Without bumblebees, tomato, potato, and blueberry would be in trouble.
No tomatoes? That'd really sting.
Last week, we dedicated Marketplace Weekend to recent college graduates and the challenges of building your adult financial life. We're still taking your questions, and we'll be back with answers in the weeks and months to come. But here are some comments you sent us, read by a few folks from the Marketplace staff. On housing, Therese Schellebarger left this message at marketplace.org.
I wish people would stop knocking renting. It allows you to get a home quickly. You can also shed your home quickly if you need to move for a better job.
And Russell Hazard sent us an email. Remember, we're weekend at marketplace.org.
I wish economics, macro and especially micro, was taught in school starting in first grade. Too soon, you say? Too complicated? Not at all, starting with the simple definition of scarce resources that need to be allocated. If one chooses one item, that limits the choices of the other items.
You can find advice on credit cards, housing, even houseplants on our website. Just go to marketplace.org. Got questions, comments? Follow us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND or subscribe to our newsletter. Here in the U.S., members of the Senate are working on a health care bill to replace the Affordable Care Act. We're going to look at a different kind of health care system now. And I want you to imagine for a minute that instead of getting prescriptions or, you know, headache medicine at the pharmacy near where you live, you get them from a street vendor, someone walking through the neighborhood with drugs piled high on their head. This is how many people in Haiti get medicine for themselves and their families. Journalist Arnaud Robert wrote about these vendors and their work in the June issue of National Geographic. It's nice to have you on.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm well. Can you describe for our listeners what these sort of pharmacy vendors, what their getup is like?
I described it as sort of chemical Babel Tower, you know, because you have, it's an amazing tower of treatments. You have all those blister packs of pills of medics, multicolored, that are showed as if it was a sort of pyramid of medicines. So it's very colorful, it's beautiful. This is the main access to medicine for Haitian people.
And why is it the main access to medicine for Haitian people?
You know, more and more it's difficult to find a legit pharmacy in Haiti, especially in outside of Port-au-Prince, but even in Port-au-Prince, because the majority of the population don't have enough money to buy their medicine in legit pharmacy stores, you know. Street sellers, basically, they have generic medicines from China, expired pills, counterfeit drugs imported from the Dominican Republic. So basically, they are cheaper than the medicine you're going to find in the pharmacies.
Is there any way to know if, say, you are buying the medicine for yourself or your child, whether you're getting the right treatment for what you are looking for?
No, it's very difficult. It's really, it's almost impossible because basically you have an industry, a pharmaceutical industry in Dominican Republic that make fake medicine just for the Haitian market. And actually, they do the packaging as if it was the real ones. You know, they just copy the packaging of the real medicines. And basically, just by watching them, we couldn't say which one was the real one.
In your story, you have a quote from, I believe it's the health minister, just sort of throwing up his hands, being so frustrated by this. And yet at the same time, it seems like it's the only way that many people who don't earn a lot of money can get medicine. Is there any sense that this is going to change?
We are working about Haiti with photographer Paolo Woods for 7 years. And one of the things that was really important for us is describing a country with a patent lack of state, you know, where state is lacking everywhere in the society. And you can see that very easily in the context of access to medicine, access to health in general. So when we met the ministry's pharmacy director, Florine Joseph, she told us how frustrated she was because basically the whole pharmacy direction at the Ministry of Health in Haiti is just based on in two containers next to the airport in Port-au-Prince, and there are just a couple of people working for that department and having to basically regulate all the street sellers and the pharmacy in the country, you know? And it's just an impossible task.
It seemed to me that when you spoke to the folks who were selling medicines, that they don't see themselves as health providers. They see themselves as, you know, businessmen and women.
When we talk about Haiti, we have the impression that this is the most remote place. This is the most exotic place, the most foreign place for somebody from the United States, for instance. But basically, this is what can become a country when it's all unregulated, when the state doesn't regulate anything, and when this is just the law of jungle that makes the market. And really, that was really interesting for us to see what's happening in a country where there is no control at all.
You can read Arnaud Robert's story, The Side Effect, in the June issue of National Geographic. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
From pills to the very core of what can determine our health, DNA. In 2012, Jennifer Doudna, along with a small group of scientists, invented a groundbreaking technology, a method to edit DNA, generally known as CRISPR. Now the prospects of genetic modification are enormous. Potentially find a cure for cancer. Amazing. Engineer foolproof teacup pigs. Adorable. Or design our own babies. Scary. Obviously, there are a lot of questions. And at Marketplace, we look at this with an economic eye. My colleague Molly Wood sat in for me last week, and she chatted with Jennifer Doudna from the Wired Conference in New York. So we're going to play you that conversation. With all of CRISPR's capabilities, Molly started by asking Jennifer Doudna what her concerns are about this new technology.
I guess I worry about a couple of things. I think there's sort of the potential for unintended consequences of gene editing in people, you know, for clinical use. How would you ever do, you know, the kinds of experiments that you might want to do to ensure safety? And then there's another application of gene editing called gene drive that involves moving a genetic trait very quickly through a population. And there's been discussion about this in the media around the use of gene drives in insects like mosquitoes to control the spread of disease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the one hand, that sounds like a desirable thing. And on the other hand, I think one, again, has to think about potential for unintended consequences of releasing a system like that into an environmental setting where you can't predict what might happen.
How important is the accessibility? You could buy a CRISPR kit online for $150. What does that kind of accessibility lead to, either in terms of opportunity or problem?
I think it's mostly a really good thing in the sense that it makes the science more tangible. And I honestly feel that things that break down the barriers between scientists and technologists and everybody else in a way that's a good thing. You know, although yes, it's easy to use this technology for those that have some training in molecular biology, it's actually not going to be very easy to do anything that would be particularly dangerous, in my opinion.
How do you think this technology could change the way we practice medicine? I mean, if we're really talking about, you know, potentially curing genetic diseases, it seems like whole industries will be affected by that.
I think it's a fascinating question, and I've been thinking about this a lot, you know, and having a number of discussions with folks that work in the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
Think about really changing the paradigm for how we do human therapeutics, at least for certain types of disease. Imagine that you had a technology or a treatment that allowed, rather than having to give someone a treatment chronically, they have to take a pill every day for the rest of their life, you had a treatment that you could do once, in principle at least, and cure them. It also brings along a lot of other issues. Who pays for that? How do you price such a thing? How do you get insurance companies to cover it? Even if there won't be easy answers, I think the first step is really just to realize that that's the moment that we're in right now.
It also, one of the things I find fascinating is sort of the intellectual property part of the conversation, to what extent people might try to patent genetically modified versions of organisms or plants, or even, human genes.
It's very difficult to patent genes. But I think you're touching on an important point, which is that, I think the real value of a technology like this that really allows research to move at a very different, much, much faster pace than it has in the past, just opens up opportunities for applications that, I think will lead to incredible, commercial opportunities and ways that people can do creative things, make products that couldn't have been, generated in the past. And along with that, of course, goes all of the issues, regard to regulation and pricing and things like that.
Jennifer, on that question of regulation and pricing, who do you think do you have a sense of what body might end up being in charge of that? Because it's really a global issue on some level, right?
It is. But I think, a lot of it will come down to initial regulatory approval. If we're talking about agricultural products in the U.S., we're talking about the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We might be talking about the Food and Drug Administration. And certainly for therapeutics, we're talking about the FDA. Of course, that affects pricing and valuations because, if there's an onerous regulatory pathway for things, then, of course, that adds to the cost of developing them. So this is why I think it's actually very important that scientists be engaging right now with these agencies to, set up appropriate regulations, of course, but also not ones that are so onerous that it really prevents development of important products.
That was CRISPR co-founder Jennifer Doudna chatting with Marketplace's Molly Wood. This is the time of year when a lot of Americans head out on a vacation, or in the case of our next guest, have just returned from one. Erin Ryan, who is a senior editor at the Daily Beast, and to be transparent, a friend, went trekking in Nepal, a country whose economy both depends on tourism and is vulnerable to it. And she wrote about that duality and the damage tourists do to parts of Mount Everest. So we asked her to come on. Erin, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Because I know you, I followed your trip on Instagram and, little bits on Twitter. But then you wrote this story, how tourists are loving Mount Everest to death. But was there a moment on your trip when you realized, oh my God, I am really not the only person doing this?
I guess the point where I realized that that things were really crowded was a couple days away from base camp. As we were walking, we passed the tree line. And as we passed the tree line, it started snowing, these big, fat, like it was like snowballs falling from the sky, basically. And at first it was kind of pretty. But then you get to this sort of zigzaggy path that's really steep, and I realized that there were just groups jam-packed in front of us. It was basically one long snaking line of hikers going up this path in this really unpleasant wet snowstorm. I sort of worried because, it's not an American national park. It's a hard trail. So the trails themselves aren't manicured and beautiful and smooth. Sometimes it's a little uneven or the soil is loose. And it was really amazing to me that more people weren't slipping and hurting themselves because it's dangerous. It's the Himalayas. You're in the middle of nowhere and it was snowing a lot. So that's when I realized that it was pretty tightly packed.
Nepal is a country that is incredibly naturally beautiful and dependent in many ways economically on the tourists who are crowding onto these trails you're talking about. What's the inflection point in terms of what you've seen between a tourist-dependent economy and yet one where tourists maybe start to degrade things.
So there's only a couple months of the year where it's the high season where it's ideal to trek. So it's basically mid-April until the end of May or September, October. And where it gets complicated is that a lot of people in Nepal earn their money through working the trails. And when there's such a short season, they really kind of cram in there and try to earn as much money as they can. I mean, Nepal's a very impoverished country. I don't blame anybody or any tourism company for trying to maximize their profits. It's become a source of real opportunity for a lot of people in Nepal. But I think that the Everest region is so unique and so inhospitable, and there's so few ways to get there that it's especially subject to too many people kind of pushing it over the edge.
Yeah, you visited other parts of the country and trekked in other areas. And what did people say to you about kind of that duality of the tourism industry and where it helps them? But is there a toll it takes on them?
The standard, what's expected when you get to Kathmandu, and this is something that they repeat to you over and over, is that it's good to hire a local guide. If you try to do the trail by yourself, you're putting yourself in danger. You might be stretching the emergency response service that they have there, which isn't extremely filled out. So, you know, you go there and you hire a local guide. One of the things I was worried about was that I had read that in the past people had hired guides and porters and really mistreated them. And there really aren't many checks from what I could see to make sure that somebody like me wasn't being like a jerk to my guides or porters. So, you know, the sort of abuse that has happened in the past is porters will not be outfitted with appropriate footwear. I did see one guy over in Annapurna, a porter walking through the same snow I was walking, and he was wearing like shower sandals and like 50 pairs of socks. I saw a lot of people wearing just plain tennis shoes into the snow, into the cold. So that's one way that the trail economy can sort of take a toll on people. Also, you know, there's the toll it just takes on your body. And when your job is to climb mountains while bearing extremely heavy loads, it takes a physical toll on your body.
You were trekking yourself. You were doing some of the walk up to Everest, and you are in Annapurna as well. Did you think about your own culpability?
My own culpability. Yeah, I did feel like part of the problem. And I think I wrote that in my story a little bit, because
you did.
On one hand I was there. I was there to enjoy this cool part of the world. And also, you know, 2 years ago, there was a devastating earthquake. More than 8,000 people died. And one of the main concerns in Nepal after the earthquake was that the tourism industry wouldn't recover because they're so tourism dependent. They were worried that, you know, people would stop coming. So now it's actually back to levels that are better than pre-earthquake levels. So it's more than bounced back since the earthquake. So on one hand, you know, you're contributing to the local economy, but on the other hand, you're contributing to crowding, you're contributing to pollution. But one thing I will say is that they're so tourism dependent that if people were not utilizing the services of people who work on the trail, there's not a ton of other jobs for a lot of those people to have.
Last question for you, because I need to know, and I think it, you know, gets to the part of all of us that is human. What's it like standing there looking at Everest?
The place where you can see it best from the Nepal side is on the top of a rise called Kalapatar. And the way that you climb Kalapatar, the way that people traditionally do it, is they wake up at 3:30 in the morning when it's still dark out, and they walk up this excruciatingly steep rise. It's about a 2-hour hike, and the top third of the mountain is just black, spiky rocks, and you have to kind of scramble over them to get to the top. I made the climb. I'm standing there, and the sun kind of peeks over the top, and I can see the shadow of the sun run down Kalapatar, and then I can feel the line of the sun running down my face, running down my neck, running down my whole body to my feet. And all of a sudden, I was warm, and the mountain was just covered with people who looked like they were about to cry. So that was kind of what made it all worth it.
Erin Ryan is a senior editor at The Daily Beast. You can read her story, How Tourists Are Loving Mount Everest to Death. Thank you so much, Erin.
Thank you.
to talk a little bit more about summer vacations now. A new poll from the Associated Press says that 43% of Americans won't take a vacation. And the top reason is they can't afford it. Summer is expensive, especially for parents. We asked a few listeners what they do with their kids when school is out.
My name is Brandon Smith. I'm a 42-year-old husband and father from Cleveland, Ohio. My wife and I have an 8-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter. The kids are going to a summer day camp at the local YMCA. The camp is $160 per week per child. Our kids will be attending 8 of the 10 weeks that the camp is offered. The location is very close to home, and the hours are great, 6:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. I wish meals were included because it's a bit expensive, but all in all, the kids have a good time and come home tired.
Figuring out what to do with your kids when you're at work isn't always easy.
My name is Carolina Hinojosa Cisneros, and I live in San Antonio, Texas.
Carolina told us that back when she was a single parent and her son was little, she'd take him to work with her.
I would have him in the back, and I was the manager, so my employees would entertain him for a little while so I could run to the front and deal with a customer. And this is how we would spend sometimes our weekends, because I had to work and I had no one. I couldn't afford childcare for him.
Now Carolina and her husband are a little better off, but sending her son to summer camp is still a challenge.
We paid for summer camp this year for a week for Boy Scouts. Luckily, he got a scholarship. Otherwise, I don't know how he would be able to attend. Now we have $10 in our bank account until the next paycheck.
We also heard from parents like Shannon Plank in Vermont, who chose to work at a school so she could have the same vacation schedule as her kids. For some advice on how parents can negotiate the summer months, we spoke with Julia Beck, founder of the It's Working Project, an organization that helps companies work with parents. She started by explaining that it's never too early in the year to start planning for summer.
The smartest solution for the summer really comes from early planning. Everything from the subsidies and the scholarships that are available, and there are a plethora of them. There's plenty to be had. You have to know where they are, which requires planning and some research, and you have to apply early. Frankly, this whole adage about, you know, summertime and living's easy, it's not accurate if you're a parent and you're working and your child is suddenly out of school. It's hard.
We heard from a lot of listeners about camps, but camps are expensive. So, you know, if you don't have several thousand dollars to set aside for camp, what do you do and how do you look?
An FSA is a great place to find this funding. You are able, again, planning, you are able to put up to $5,000 aside a year for a dependent for anything. That includes camp. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there are absolutely dollars to be had. It's just a matter of getting to the bottom of what's available.
You mentioned an FSA, and I think a lot of families or individuals really think about those flexible spending accounts as something for medical expenses or maybe for childcare, but they don't think about them for camp. How do you talk to your employer and say, wait a minute, is this something that you have that I can take advantage of?
Well, it is certainly a question you should ask. I, in my research, was speaking with an employer, big one, but Bank of America, and they actually offer a consultant to help their employees to figure out best uses. So not everybody has that benefit, but it's a brilliant benefit because instead of just saying there's an FSA, good luck to you, they say there's an FSA, let's figure out what your needs are this year. It's about self-advocacy. If you do not have an employer who is helping you to use your FSA to your benefit, that is a very simple, straightforward conversation to have with HR.
I want to play some tape from another listener who told us she pays a total of about $3,200 to send two of her kids to camp for the whole summer. But she adds this one little concern on the back. Let's play that tape.
My name is Stephanie Schumacher from Ann Arbor, Michigan. The other thing that we have factored into the cost of summer camps and childcare is the post-care and the pre-care, because if you work a 9-to-5 job, most camps really don't run 9-to-5 or after that. So a lot of camps add on an additional $10 to $25 a day for post-care or pre-care.
Is that a place, these sort of extra bits around the margins, where you see families running up against walls trying to figure out, you know, can I get a grandparent to pick somebody up and hang out with them for an hour or two?
It's a huge wall, and having grandparents available is about as good as it gets in terms of having a loving face show up at the end of the day for your child. What could be better than that? The next best thing, of course, is building a community, a co-op type environment with friends and neighbors. There are also ways in which, again, back to the employer thing, there are ways in which employers actually pay for the backup care, those edges, that early and that late, so that it will at least be subsidized. So at least the dollars don't continue to tick up.
When we think about summer dollars, a big cost is food. What kind of stresses does the summer put on families that, you know, rely on free and reduced lunches or breakfast at schools?
That is a very scary, underserved market. You have children who are used to having breakfast at school and lunch at school. That's two meals a day at school that are no longer being served to them at school. There are organizations, and thank goodness for these organizations all over the country, who work very hard to make sure that these needs are met. They thrive most actually on the state and county level, but it is important that you take the time to really figure out what your options are so that you and your child are included for the season.
Let's say you're listening to this, and maybe like me, you're somebody who does things at the last minute. And I know, research, preparation, but, you know, if you're freaking out a little bit, are there good resources where you can turn, even at this moment?
There absolutely are. I'm a big fan of the YMCA camps. I think the Salvation Army, believe it or not only has day, but also overnight camps. There are a lot of places to turn to right now. Your rate might be better next year once you apply what we've talked about, but it doesn't mean you won't still get a great camp experience on that lower end of the cost spectrum. Again, it can range from $100 a week, which is not a little bit, but all the way up to $2,000 a week, you know, for a private overnight camp. So it's not too late to build a really quality summer. And let's not overlook the fun that we used to have back in the day. There is still a way to have a great deal of fun in the early evenings as a family when everybody is home together. It doesn't have to be that you provide for nonstop fun all day long. There are ways in which you can engage relatives, neighbors, the community to build experiences that are cost-free.
Julia Beck, founder of the It's Working Project, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's stay with that summer thing and listen to these kids telling their class what they did with their vacations.
And then the raccoons ate our food and we all got poison ivy. And that was my vacation. We drive and drive and drive some more. And that was my vacation.
After I went to a haunted mansion, I traveled into the future and hung out with famous movie stars. And then I was attacked by aliens, got caught in a tidal wave, and went all the way to China.
Okay, he didn't really go to China. That's a Disney commercial from 1996. Companies like Disney have long marketed theme parks as a vacation for families. But Disney's attendance actually dropped last year for the first time in more than a decade and after a price hike. Yeah, they're still making money. U.S. theme parks generated about $20 billion in revenue last year, but not necessarily from the middle-class consumers of 20 years ago. So if you want to hit one without losing your mind or your savings, you should listen to Robert Niles. He's the editor of ThemeParkInsider.com. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what is going on this year? Why did Disney's attendance fall?
Well, Disney had a really good year the year before, and this past year just wasn't as good as the previous year. Disneyland was coming off its big 60th anniversary celebration where they had a bunch of new shows and a big ad campaign for that. And this year, really all Disneyland had to offer was a big construction zone as they get ready for Star Wars Land up in 2019. And Orlando just had a horrible year last year, if you remember the Pulse shooting.
The Pulse shooting, of course.
They had a hurricane there. That tragic accident that involved a youngster from Nebraska losing his life in an alligator attack. It's just, I don't think you could script something more bizarre than what happened in Orlando last year. And Disney World just didn't have anything to overcome that the way that, say, their rivals at Universal did last year. So that's why we saw a dip in attendance for Disney in 2016.
So you think it would be going too far to say this is just about the fact that the Disney parks raised prices?
Well, they certainly didn't help themselves with that. I mean, one of the classic strategies, if you are facing a soft year, is to cut your prices. But Disney didn't do that last year. So we'll see if they have any discounts or anything that they try and do on a short-term basis going forward. But in fact, Disney's just bringing out a bunch of new attractions over the next few years. So I think they're relying on that to help boost attendance rather than getting into a discounting strategy.
You know, when I think about a family vacation at a theme park, it has been for years marketed as a middle class summer mm-hmm. experience that you can take your kids. But these are really expensive now, not just Disney, but across the board.
Yeah. If you're looking at a full 1 week vacation down in Orlando to visit the Walt Disney World Resort, I think the average family of four is probably spending somewhere between about $3,500 to $7,000. And that's before you look at transportation
wow.
costs to get down to Orlando. Now, obviously, if grandma and grandpa live down there and you don't need to get a hotel, you can shave some money off of that. But if you're looking at airplane flights along with that and you want to hop between various parks on the same day, you could easily look at $10,000 for a week vacation in Orlando.
Well, so let's talk about that. Let's say you're thinking, wow, that really does sound like a lot of money, but I want to take my kids to a theme park. I want to have this kind of experience. How do you go about both finding the place and then figuring out the money part of it?
Well, the good news is there's lots of opportunities for advanced planning on the internet. I run a site that does a lot of brings a lot of people together to rate and review parks. So there's a wide variety of experiences out there. It's not just the Disney Universal experience. There's if you're a roller coaster fan, there's great parks like Cedar Point in outside of Cleveland, Ohio, Six Flags Magic Mountain outside of Los Angeles. But if you're looking for something that's a little bit more of a themed experience, maybe something like one of the Busch Gardens theme parks in Williamsburg or Tampa, Florida might be more what your family is looking for. So it's really a matter of getting familiar with what's available in the market and then pricing those options to see what fits your family's style and budget.
And if you do decide to do it, I assume the sort of insidery rules of don't buy stuff inside that
right,
you can get outside.
Right.
How does that work?
One of my big pieces of advice is obviously buy your tickets in advance so that you're not making a last-minute decision at the gate. But also don't buy anything inside the park that you can get outside of the park. If you're looking for a particular souvenir, you might be able to shop around online and find it for cheaper than you will inside the park where you're paying a premium.
Good luck explaining that to a six-year-old.
Well, that's the thing. Actually, one of the things that really works for me is make your child spend their own money. I mean, get them to do chores in advance, give them an allowance, however you want to do it. But start talking up the vacation in advance and say, hey, you want to save your money for anything that you want to buy in the park. We did this with our kids, and it was amazing to see them transform into these eagle-eyed consumer advocates inside the park, pricing everything going around and deciding how they were. I think it was the most valuable lesson we ever taught them about money. And it was a theme park visit that inspired us to do it.
Stepping back for a second, when we think about the middle class and the way you phrase this, some of the big companies going for upscale consumers, mm-hmm. where does the business go in the next decade? Does it fracture? Does it become, a strange outpost of inequality?
Yeah, if you look at what's happened to the hotel business and the countless number of brands and infinite price points that we have with that, I think the same thing is really happening in the theme park business. I mean, it's not just about the ticket. It's there's the ticket, there's the on-site hotel or off-site hotel. Do you want something that includes, transportation from the airport or not? They've got all of these upcharge experiences that you can get. You can go to this thing called the Bibbidi Bobbidi Boutique inside of a Disney theme park where they will make up your daughter to look like a princess. They've got after-hours Halloween
wow.
parties, special fireworks viewing parties with dessert. All of these things are upcharges that fragment the market and provide them many more price points to try and get as much money out of the market as a park can. So I think that's the direction we're heading with this. It's not just the one price-fits-all strategy that you might have seen in the past. It's really becoming more about a mix and match of various options to find something that matches a price point you're comfortable with and gives you the level of service that you can afford.
Before I let you go, I'm just curious, how many theme parks do you think you hit in a summer?
In a single summer, at least a dozen, I would say. Usually I'd throw in some type of road trip across the country in addition to my visits to the big capitals in Orlando and Anaheim. But I think the past 12 months or so, I've been ahead of my average. So I think I've probably done close to 20.
Wow. Robert Niles, editor of ThemeParkInsider.com, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. One of the great mysteries of the Father's Day holiday, to me anyway, is why it has become inextricably linked with grilling. Seriously, any Father's Day gift guide always has some piece of grilling paraphernalia. And yeah, I mean, my dad is good with a grill, but this is 2017. So am I. Anyway, according to the Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association, yes, grilling has a trade group, Father's Day is the fourth most popular grilling day of the year. So we're going to honor fathers, father figures, and, you know, those of us who are just into cooking things over fire, with a few tips from Stuart Meyer, the CEO of the National Barbecue and Grilling Association. Meyer's number one tip for basic grilling?
Don't puncture your meat too much. The juices are going to leak out, and you're going to end up with dry pieces of meat.
Dry is definitely bad, but also don't stress too much. You can be creative.
Experiment with it. Have fun. You know, I like to add hardwood chunks to my direct flame. Personally, I really love oak wood for grilling steaks.
For the record, Meyer also grills vegetables like asparagus and portobello mushrooms. Now, if you are ready to transition from some basic all-American grilling to some fancier smoking techniques, you don't have to go buy a big green egg. Just do this.
You can take any regular charcoal grill and turn it into a smoker simply by buying some offset smoker pans to create on one side of the grill your fire, and then on the other side of the grill is where you can place your meat.
Just remember,
barbecue and grilling is love. It brings us together, it connects us,
and it gives us some pretty damn good food. For more tips on grilling and barbecue, go to our webpage, marketplace.org. You can also find Meyer's favorite recipe of the moment. And happy Father's Day. And that's it for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Paulina Velasco. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer, and Brian Allison is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.